Welcome to AUP Radio, a melting pot of voices and ideas. Closing out the ninth week, we again bring you the breakdown and let's talk about God. Finally, we'll have 15 minutes of fame. Enjoy the show.
WRP Radio listeners, this is Kathleen Sharp, and I'm joined by the wonderful Isabel Geeky.
Hello, everyone.
And today we are running The Breakdown, which is a breakdown of the top three stories or articles produced by the American University of Paris's student media platforms. So today we have two articles and one video to share with you, and these articles are available on peacockplume.fr, which is all student-run student journalism, and then we also have Peacock Play YouTube channel, which is the same thing, all shot and directed and edited by the students here at the American University of Paris.
Right, so those are largely the content produced by the video journalism practicum, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
And that's the one that we're going to start off talking about today, actually.
All right. Tell me about it, Kat.
This video is called Stirring It Up, the Vegan Vibe at AUP. And this video is all about the vegan club, which has been, you know, I think gaining some traction on campus lately. And I've noticed them all over at events and giving free food and trials. And what the club is all about is basically just letting people who aren't vegans or not vegetarians or who are just, you know, regular consumers of meat and dairy, the opportunity to taste a vegan food and learn about it and why they feel like people should become vegans.
Absolutely. And so the club president is Claire Lyons, right?
Chloe, yeah.
Chloe Lyons. Last night she was running the booth for the vegan club at the Thanksgiving feast in the American church.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
So there were vegan options open to the student body last evening.
And the mashed potatoes that they had there were with almond milk instead of regular butter.
And they were delicious.
I didn't have any. I saved them for vegan people. I'm not vegan, but I am pescatarian. And I really appreciate seeing some of those more efforts, I think, around campus to be not only cruelty-free, but to reduce our carbon footprint. And I think that's their, a lot of what this video is talking about is actually the carbon footprint and the ecological consequences of animal products.
Absolutely. So as Kat said in the video, the production, I guess, covers not only the vegan club's activities, and it shows Chloe cooking and making vegan dishes and enjoying them with friends, but it also discusses the impact on land use of agriculture and of methane emissions, mm-hmm. and how that gets trapped in the atmosphere.
Yeah, because also I know, just not from the video but from other readings that I've done, is that a lot of the deforestation happening in the world is because of agribusiness and wanting to, you know, have land for right. livestock. And so it's, you know, there's the actual production of the meat and the animals and their food and whatever that's causing issues. But then there's also this deforestation on top of that that's rapidly increasing, especially we're seeing it in South America with Bolsonaro's presidency.
Mm-hmm. And I think Chloe made a great point when she said that it's a moral imperative not only for animals' lives, but also for human lives to switch to a plant-based diet. So as Kat said, she's pescatarian. I'm vegetarian. I've been vegetarian for 5 years, 6 years, something like that.
I think it's been 9 years for me.
And it's really a very easy switch to make. I mean, you eliminate a lot of options if you're someone like me who's very indecisive and has a lot, has a hard time picking something to eat in a restaurant. That eliminates a lot of the options.
That's funny. I never thought about it like that.
And it's a cheaper way to live. I mean, as a student, we're on a tight budget, and I can limit my groceries to 15 euros a week by buying lots of lentils, vegetables, rice. So you eat very well as a veggie already, not even mentioning being a vegan. So I've really appreciated her point, which I think is also coming more into the mainstream as how veganism is perceived, because I think in the first years of this trend of veganism, which I think really started gaining steam when we were in middle school, perhaps.
Maybe
5 or 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. At first, it was kind of branded as some very radical notion.
Yeah,
too
like
extreme.
An annoying, extremist, radical, liberal agenda is, I think, how a lot of people would consider it. Not that I think it's like that, but that's how I think it was seen. And now it's much more mainstream. There's so many celebrities and athletes who are vegan and who are who speak about that openly. And I think that also there has been a shift. It's less now people talking about the animal cruelty side of it, where it used to be like shaming and blaming and, you know, like PETA kind of guilting a lot of people. And now I think that there's, you know, people aren't trying to make other people feel so culpable. It's trying to be like, come on, like get on board, you
it's
know,
about
instead
being abnormally conscious.
You're a bad person. Mm-hmm. And that, and in the video, the vegan club leader, Chloe, she says that, you know, I don't think that people who aren't vegan are bad people.
Right.
She's like, I don't think they're bad people. I think they just haven't realized the power of making the switch to veganism, you know?
Absolutely. And I think this is something also in climate conversation, whether it was Ivani or Signe hosting, I don't remember. But they also wanted to drive home this point that it's not about making a radical change and absolutely switching your diet from one day to another. It's about making a little change, trying to implement healthier habits, not only for you, but for the world, and seeing how that plays out to everyone's advantage. So, Kat, what is story number two?
So the next story that we have, this one is on peacockplume.fr, which, you know, is very easy to access for everybody. Mm-hmm. It's English language. Anywho, this article is called Your Parisian Guide for the Holiday Season by Sofia Quintero. And she's writing about different holiday festivities around Paris and where you should get out and go to. And the first one that she talks about are the different Christmas markets, which date back, which originated in Germany in 14th century, she says, and have, I guess, made their way all across Europe and France and maybe across the world even. But I've been to a couple of Christmas markets before, but I think the one that I know the best is the one at the Tuileries Garden near the Louvre. Have you ever been to there?
Is it the one that lines the Champs-Élysées?
No.
Or it's within the Jardin Tuileries?
Yeah, it's in the Tuileries.
Okay, yeah,
and
know.
They've got different rides. They have, like, funnel cake and I think maybe they might have an ice skating rink. They have bumper cars.
Nice.
It's really cute. And just there's hot wine and there's hot chocolate and everything hot and warm and cozy and romantic. If you have a boyfriend or girlfriend or other significant other, you should bring them there.
And you mentioned ice skating. I know that ice skating is a big hit in the Grand Palais, which is a huge museum, in which they've also, they stripped sometimes for Paris Passion Week.
For Paris Fashion Week.
So the Grand Palais is always home to
a lot of
eclectic events throughout the year, and they turn it into an ice skating rink.
Yeah, this one is, I think it opens on December 16th, and it's through January 9th. I am going to try to make it in there before I head back. I'm going home for the holiday season, but I want to get a chance to go and do that. I am not a good ice skater, though, I'll tell you that.
From what I know, there's also an ice skating rink. I don't think that Ms. Quintero mentioned it in her article, but there's also ice skating on the top of the Montparnasse Tower.
Oh, really?
Because what I know is that this summer I found out there was a trampoline on top of the tower in the summer, and in the winter they have ice skating. And I think they also have a rink now on the top of La Défense, but that's to be determined.
Wait, how cute. I feel like I'm going to go and do that.
Skating
maybe
all over.
If I can't make it into the Grand Palais, then I'll go to Montparnasse or to the,
La Défense. So you have Plan B and Plan C, because I'm guessing Le Grand Palais will be quite...
pretty booked.
Right.
Especially the first couple nights.
And then The last piece.
Okay, so the last piece, also available on peacockplume.fr, is Live Your Best With Less, How Does Minimalism Impact Your Mental Health? And this is by Prisma Guimar. And she is discussing this trend of minimalism. You know, everybody, I think, has an idea of what minimalism is, but it's the idea that having fewer possessions and buying fewer things and, you know, decluttering your space by, you know, getting rid of the things you no longer need or think you need, and giving them to the less fortunate, donating them, and living in this kind of like bliss, like clutter-free, or like not, it doesn't necessarily have to be clutter-free, I think, as long as you love and treasure and value and use everything that you have. Mm-hmm. But she talks about the effect of that on mindfulness and your well-being, and like the importance it can have too for your building personal relationships, because the less time that you're spent obsessing over material goods and things, the more time you can think about what really matters to you. She mentions meditating, you know, having your life and space filled up by the people that matter to you instead of objects. And it's funny that we're talking about this today on Black Friday.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I'm guessing that was her news angle.
The day of mass consumerism, which is super popular in the U.S. and popular here too in France. I'm seeing a bunch of sale signs all over Paris.
Which is strange, because actually in France, sales are limited to the season of solde in July and February. So I don't know how that's permissible, legally speaking. But in any event, I do think Prisma was right to put out this article at this point in time.
I must admit, yesterday I did go Black Friday shopping, but it was not... I know.
And it wasn't Friday.
And it wasn't. They started on Thursday and they go through Sunday, they said at the Galerie.
That's right. They're branding it as Black Week now.
Black Week, yeah. Which just sounds like such a strange name for what they're trying to describe.
But anyway.
And I got a pair of shoes, though, and these are actually a necessity, because the only other shoes that I have are heeled or white. And it's winter in Paris, so... I did get something that I need.
Minimalist.
All right. I'll need them. I treasure them. And they did actually kind of make me happy, I must admit. But actually, something that I've been hearing of more and more of late is this idea of boycotting like mass consumer and like consumption days. Mm-hmm. So this writer in the magazine class that I'm the editor for at the American University of Paris, she wrote an article that's coming out shortly about boycott Christmas. Mm-hmm. And during that, it's like during the Christmas season, you know, refusing to accept or give gifts to people.
And rather to exchange experiences, right?
Yeah, experiences or... Just not at all giving or getting anything. Yes.
And I mean, I would not be opposed to getting concert tickets for Christmas if Santa's listening. Just gonna leave that there.
I think the older and older I get, the every year I'm like, when my parents ask me what I want for Christmas, I'm like, I have no idea.
I always ask for socks.
Socks, you can always use socks. My mom sends me socks, actually. That's one thing she sends me in care packages. She doesn't even do care packages. What she does is she just adds a bunch of things to an Amazon.fr wish list and sends them to me. I'm like, it's like the modern care package for your college student. It's sweet, though. I really like it.
That is sweet.
But back to the article, yeah.
For the article that you teased. And I know, Kat, that also the magazine is launching soon. Isn't that right?
Yep. So Peacock Magazine is launching on December 5th.
Which is a semesterly issue.
Mm-hmm. And you guys will be able to find it by looking for it, hopefully shortly, on the peacockplume.fr website. And if not, we have an issue account, ISSUU, mm-hmm. and you can search up Peacock Magazine and American University of Paris
and
to find
page
it.
Through. And if you want a hard copy, stop by university or any of the commerces surrounding. We are located in the 7th arrondissement of Paris, and we also have older issues if you are curious to page through them a bit.
Exactly.
So I'm very excited about this issue. I got to work with
so
Kat on
excited.
One of the articles.
Yep, you wrote into it. And it's got a great theme too. So
I'm just going to tease that right there. So thank you, Kat. And do you have any
Well, thank you for being on
words?
The breakdown. I would just say have a great weekend, everybody.
And stay warm.
Welcome back to the Let's Talk About God radio show. This is Bear, your host, and we are welcoming two guests today. Please introduce yourselves.
Hi, everybody. My name is Oscar Hartzog. I'm a junior here at AUP. I'm from San Francisco. We're talking about my beliefs.
Yeah. What did you grow up in? What do you
I grew
now?
Up agnostic, and I continue to be agnostic to this day, but I would say it has intensified in both directions. Made me even more agnostic, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, being a philosophy major too, I imagine that could happen very easily.
Yeah, philosophy. Yeah. I know you're both somehow, but it's pretty hard.
Certainly changes a lot of it. I'm Fiona McMurray. You know me as the deputy producer, Afne Pierre Petit Four. I'm originally from Austin, Texas, and I come from a family of philosophers, so all of my upbringing has been based on a lot of emphasis on metaphysics and absurdism primarily. So my beliefs stand primarily in the field of quantum mechanics, as that's what I can like rationally associate with metaphysics and absurdism. And yeah, I have a lot of theories on that, but I'm sure we'll get to discuss some of that.
Cool. Quantum mechanics, cool. That'll perfectly tie into what we're talking about today. Yeah.
I'm a little intimidated.
Yeah. So today we're going to be talking about time, species of eternity, and through Spinoza, and we're going to incorporate, you know, some quantum physics as well. Yep. Why not? I took a class on that one, so I could maybe hold a little bit of my own. But yeah, we'll see what happens. So, eternity. You just wrote an essay on it, Oscar.
Eternity. I just wrote an essay on it. Eternity in Spinoza, which is different than the eternity we usually imagine as endless time. Spinoza comes up with an idea of eternity that's completely separate from time and can't be explained through time vocabulary. And this species, or it's just a whole different concept where everything is, will be, and has happened at all times, so it can't be explained in past, present, and future so much. And this is the realm that God exists in for Spinoza. And the rest of my essay was figuring out why humans have this linear idea of time, even though we exist we are you know, connected to God, or we're expressions of God who is eternal. So
I know that there are many implications for God being in eternity. So if you could just kind of enumerate that a little bit and talk a little bit about how God could act within eternity.
Mm-hmm. So Spinoza's God that exists in eternity, in the special kind of eternity, instead of just having always existed and existing for forever, there are no decrees of God as is commonly imagined in religion, whereby like X amount of years ago, God created the universe, you know, X amount of years ago.
Like God spoke.
God spoke. Yeah, sure. Instead, it's just everything, like, again, always has, is, and will happen. So it's more of a God sustaining the universe instead of continually offering these decrees or creating people. It's just this kind of one big mass of, like, things happening.
And so, and this is where we'll tie into some quantum mechanics, but in your paper, you use an example of how we have come under the notion of time as linear. And in your examples, you used the moving of a watch or just moving of objects in general.
Yeah.
So why would that actually make us think that time is linear?
So Spinoza's quote is that we imagine time because we imagine bodies to move now more slowly, now more quickly, which is super vague. But basically that means we imagine one body to have in its essence something that either brings about its existence or brings about its end. So we might say, you know, a candle has a duration of 10 minutes or whatever, but really it has nothing to do with the candle. It has to do with the flame and when somebody lit it, when it became nighttime. So there's this endless causality or infinity causality. And that's how we get this idea of time. So like, I mean, if we go big with it, like the earth spinning gives us the idea of one day, but really there's nothing in the earth that makes it spin. It's a whole, don't know too much about astronomy, but it's the pull of the sun and the way the universe was created that began the spun or however it is. But in the end, it has nothing to do with the duration of specific things. But that's where we get our idea of linear time and how we base it.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Let's Talk About God on AEP Radio, brought to you by WRP. It's 9:20.
It's really interesting, actually. To read you the opening of this paper that I'm writing about time, which is a little bit different because it features in a lot of more linguistic technicalities. But I've always associated as time chronicling the eclipse of our existence, the arduously arbitrary passing of our days, and the awakening of our consciousness until the immortal finitude of death. And then the elastic condition of time is ostensibly the closest thing we have to a calculable existential purpose, and that it syncretizes with the absurdity of being elapsing indomitably with an aggressive indifference to everything we do. In this sense, I was kind of thinking that what you mentioned about time just existing in motion, obviously that's Spinoza's predicament, but I was also wondering how you would factor in Kant's argument that God exists beyond this scheme of time, and how the infinite causality it occurs, but God is beyond that, and then how everything else occurs like within time, even the infinite. So it's I don't know, just the disparity between those two.
Yeah. So in my essay about Spinoza, I said that there's God exists in eternity, and then within God is everything else, so humans, and then time is just kind of this illusion that humans made up as like a tool for living, basically. So it's not bad. It's just like a tool that humans made up. It's much smaller than, I think time in Spinoza is much smaller than it is in our mind when we say the philosophy of time or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eternalism as it is. But I mean, because Kant's argument is, of course, that God exists beyond the infinite, which I find very interesting because, of course, obviously we can't fathom that in any regard. But it just presents an interesting facet to his religiosity.
Yeah.
Do you know if Kant's ever read any Plotinus or like any of the Neoplatonists?
Definitely, yes. Yeah. I love that. Yeah, he's the influence of Neoplatonism is evident in most of his work. I mean, from the imperative of morality that you can derive from Avicenna's Falling Man to a number of his pieces. Yeah, you can definitely see a lot of Plotinus's work in there.
I mean, just from the what you just said about how he reasons that God is beyond infinity, it sounds very Neoplatonist, saying like God is beyond being. It's like the one or the all, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's pretty interesting, because if within Spinoza's framework, I would agree with much of it. But in your essay, as I was reading, because I didn't really fully get into time within the ethics, I was getting into some other things. But in reading that, I began to understand that God within the ethics, since God is also within eternity, so basically within the ethics, Spinoza says that God can only be determined by God's self. And right. So if God is within a species of eternity, then he also says that nothing else could have been any other way than it is, because there was no start and there is no end. Mm-hmm. So even if God wanted to, it could not have been done any other way. But that doesn't necessarily make, I don't know, maybe it's because I don't fully understand eternity, fully understand what Spinoza is saying, but if God is the cause of himself and is totally free, by definition of seven in the ethics, he fully acts, and God is the only one that acts upon it, and nothing acts upon God. So then how could God be constrained to eternity?
Well, he says God is a free cause, I think. I don't think he says he has free will.
He says he doesn't have free will.
Yeah, so it's a different thing than being a free cause. And I think that's the hang up, because we can't imagine, we imagine like choice and action in picking choices as this free will, but for Spinoza, God is like, for Spinoza, if God had two choices and he picked one, that would imply imperfection, I think, because then he could have gone another way. There could have been a different, there's contingency in the universe, which for him doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's more of a question of our understanding of free will.
So then if you know the answer to this, Fiona, but, or if you could speculate as to what it would be, if God, under Kant's example or Plotinus or the Neoplatonist example, if that God was outside of infinity or outside of eternity, then would God be able to choose, or would God not be choosing but still just acting without the actual, like, without actual choice? Because God would just be doing that.
I think that God, I mean, would have to be acting with choice. I mean, I think with the conception of free will, I mean, obviously I've read way too much Sartre for my own good, and do believe that every action is the consequence of this responsibility of free will. And so if there is a God existing outside of eternity, they're certainly acting with free will. Also, one thing that I think that it's very interesting that Kant doesn't point out, and I notice that Spinoza doesn't really point out either, is how in a lot of Eastern Zen tenets, there tends to be this, in linguistically, there's a verticality that we don't have in English. So we necessarily have to have these separations in eternity and the infinite. And of course, it almost seems strange to us for everything to occur at once, for there to be no beginning or no end. And yet in their linguistics, in Japanese and also Mandarin Chinese, there is no past tense, and Japanese there are conjugations, but Mandarin Chinese, and that helps define an easier acceptance of the infinite that I just don't think that we have in the same capacity.
So there's no conjugations for any, I'm confused, there's no conjugations for any past tense.
In Mandarin Chinese, you don't conjugate necessarily. You refer to something in, like, you could make a reference to, like, tomorrow, or this particular thing was that other day. Like, you'd make, like, a reference in nouns, and then in Japanese, you don't have a proper past tense.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would make my essay a lot easier.
Yeah, but it's really interesting to note the evolution of our separate philosophies, Eastern and Western, based upon our linguistic tendencies, for example. I mean, we've been talking about this sort of horizontality within the infinite. I mean, obviously, like, perhaps not with the beginning or an end, so it's not entirely horizontal, but Western philosophers only arrive at that at a certain point, and then we still don't have room for paradox the way that they do in the verticality of time. So interesting linguistic notion.
Yeah, that's super cool. I don't even know how to go off that, honestly. Yeah. I was actually thinking the other day.
I guess you have to learn Japanese.
Seriously. I was actually thinking the other day, it's like within like the Western world, we only really learn about Western philosophers. I'm like, well, there's philosophers on the other side as well. Like, why haven't we been learning about any of them? Because I know relatively nothing about Eastern philosophy, other than like the rabbit holes I went down a few years ago when I was getting into like Buddhism and Hinduism and such like that. And then it was more mystics than philosophers. And I think that honestly they could make a lot more sense out of what Plotinus says about the one, because it seems like they do have a better grasp on paradoxes, mm-hmm. whereas over in the Western world, we're constantly trying to be like, oh, God exists, God doesn't exist, God exists, God doesn't exist. There's all these debates on that and many other things of like whether there is truth or there isn't truth. It's like it's one side or the other. Mm-hmm. And I think that oftentimes within quantum theory, especially, there's these paradoxes that we can't actually get our mind around. Like in the double slit experiment, we can't fully understand what, if an electron is a wave or a particle, when it's actually just neither or. And so it's like, if we are seeing this paradox within the universe, it's like, can there be just both of the same thing? Can there be both God and not God? Can there, you know? Yeah.
This is what we were talking about with free will and determinism.
Yeah.
me and Bear were talking about free will and determinism, and I liked Bear's response that it's just both.
It sounds like a cop out, but at the same time, it's a
reasonable response.
I fully agree.
But again, like, that would probably be easier to discuss in a language with more verticality, or Eastern philosophy or anything.
There's this great book of Zen koans. So, like, a koan is a... Let me just pull it up really quickly so I don't want to say it's the wrong thing. But they're paradoxes intended to nullify logic in order to reach enlightenment. So, basically, you're supposed to transcend certain pieces of logic, or, like, for example, we were talking about, like, free will or determinism. Like, you pick one, you know, in a logical standpoint, but a koan would reconcile the two of them. And there's a lot of them in this great piece called The Gateless Barrier. And of course, naturally, that's a paradox in and of itself, the title, and that's a koan. And there's this great quote: an ancient once said that things passing through this gate could never be your own treasures. Whatever you gain from external circumstances are extinguished in the end. So there's a lot of things like that where they're more easily able to reconcile these paradoxes. And I really think that if we had that in our language, it would be so much easier for us to rationalize a lot of these philosophies, but not necessarily rationalize, because then again, that's basically what Western thought is structured on, is the rationalization of everything. But
yeah. It almost sounds like, have you read any Zeno's paradoxes?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, the one that could really apply to this would be like, I mean, no, he didn't do this, but it's like, say you're walking across like a football field. There's an infinite amount of points to get from one yard line to the next yard line. And so it's like, how do you actually get to the next one when you're going across infinite amount of points? Because if you divide it in half, you divide that in half, divide that in half, and so on and so forth. There's an infinite amount of points.
It's the same thing with time.
So how would you say that one, because we were just talking about this as well, and this is in your essay, how would one act within, as Spinoza calls, a species of eternity? How could one develop a mind like that?
So at the end of the Ethics, and actually a little bit in the middle, but Spinoza talks about like tapping into the certain species of eternity, he calls it, which is reason. And so that would mean finding out everything about a triangle. Because the rules of a triangle, or the essence of a triangle, exists in eternity. And so by learning that, you're tapping into eternity, is what I said. And so in that way, that's the only way to shed these like chains of like false linear time.
You know, because when I hear species of eternity, and thinking about that, it's like, and like we were talking about earlier today as well, Fiona, I'm sorry if you don't know too much Spinoza, but we've been really on the Spinoza train recently.
Yeah, we're fanboys.
Yeah, we're fanboys, seriously.
I get that.
Baruch's the guy. So earlier we were talking about how, because I'm reading his theological political treatise currently, and it seems as though, and within the Bible, there's a certain correlation here too. Paul says that he's praying for the Ephesians to be filled with the knowledge of God's will. And so for Spinoza, he actually equates God's will with God's understanding. And so one could say that under a species of eternity, one would be filled with the understanding of God in a certain sense, or God's will. And so when I'm thinking about species of eternity, we were talking about this with our professor a bit ago, it would be like you are within the present, but you're knowing almost a little bit about what's going to be happening around you in the space of time. Mm-hmm. And so that would make shed a lot of light on prophets within the Old Testament and Jesus as well, because what Spinoza writes within the theological political treatise is that I'll just use one example. For Moses, in the parting of the Red Sea, it was said that there was an east wind that blew and it moved the Red Sea over, and so they were able to cross. And at the end, when they got out, in Exodus, it just said that Moses raised up his hand and it went back. But mm-hmm. in Song of Songs, it said that there's a west wind that blew it back. And mm-hmm. so it was like Moses was at the right place at the exact right time, is because he was filled with the knowledge of God's will through his imagination on what to do. And so it could be seen as a miracle or a wonder that he raised his hand and it moved back, when really he was actually just placed at the correct time, at the correct place at the exactly the right time, because he was filled with the knowledge of God's will or the next kind of step of what was going to happen. How do you think that would factor into, I don't know, anything that you had written?
Well, my guess would be that Spinoza would say that Moses used his reason incredibly well to find out about perfect meteorological predictions, and then kept it a secret, and then went and just figured out where the wind would be blowing exactly the right time using his reason, and in that way tapped into eternity.
Mm. Does Kant or any of the philosophers that you're knowledgeable about, do they talk about like prophecy or miracles or anything like that? Because you and I had a brief discussion about miracles the other day.
Yeah, actually, I mean, I would bring up Hegel, but of course he you know, associates history in so many synthetic ways, or in the sense that are in dialectical forms. So naturally, things are bound to repeat themselves. But what I want to address here is less of a philosophical perspective and more of a quantum mechanical one, in the sense that you could almost see prophecy. So accepting that string theory is true, everything is composed of a series of, you know, subatomic strings, and they're all interconnected. Everything else is a perception of a vibration of those strings. You could associate prophecy or any sort of divination with a certain oscillation transmitted through that, if that makes sense. So you'd send out a wavelength and that would affect everything else. So
interesting.
Yeah, potentially there's a correlation between that and prophecy, however I'm not sure.
Okay, so it would be like almost like you sending out like a certain wavelength to these strings, and it would then happen within the exterior world, or
yeah,
what?
It could happen in the external world, or the world that's being perceived is it Deepak Chopra? Someone said that we are the universe perceiving itself. And so on like a mathematical level, we would be like something would be transmitted. And then if there was no infarction or anything to the wave, then it would just keep going through. So yeah, I guess the perception would reflect whatever's happening on like a very subatomic level. Hmm. That makes sense.
Interesting. Hmm. What would you say about miracles?
I don't know. I'm not sure I believe in coincidence. I think there's some things are too specific to be coincidence, but I think it also has to do with that quantum mechanical structure, where if there's some, perhaps it's an unconscious thing that you send out some sort of vibrational wavelength or something, then it's reciprocated or it comes back to you in a way you don't expect, and we could perceive that as a miracle, but in all honesty, I'm not entirely sure.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, that'd be definitely, that'd be hard to get to, especially because miracles are like it's like they, you can't really test them, you know?
Yeah.
You can't really get around them. I like Spinoza's, and we're kind of diverging from time here a little bit, but actually, we'll bring it back. So for miracles within Spinoza's framework, it all just kind of has to do with timing, or some of them do at least. Mm. I mean, Jesus walking on the water, I don't know if that could be explained through Spinoza's framework, but maybe we'll see. I'm doing my thesis on this, so maybe I'll try to delve into that.
Yeah, I'm interested.
Yeah. But yeah, for miracles, I find it super interesting because being Christian, you know, a lot of the time, and even reading the Bible, it says a lot of the time that a lot of things are attributed to God. So like something could be of God, or mm-hmm. like a strong wind would be a wind of God. And the way that Spinoza actually explains this is that many things were attributed to God when they didn't actually understand what it was. Mm-hmm. And so, and one of the examples of this that really struck me, because I actually had a hard time like understanding what this was in the Bible, I think about a month ago, was Saul was afflicted by an evil spirit of God. And I was like, wait, that's not the God that's described within the Bible, and an all-loving God afflicting somebody with an evil spirit. And so I was like, how does this make sense? And so seeing this explanation of the fact that when something is so vast or unexplainable, it could be they attributed it by saying of God, because it doesn't really make sense to them. And so same thing could be said about certain miracles or things that happen. Certain things are of God because it doesn't necessarily make sense or doesn't line up, and they couldn't like you were saying, Oscar, it's like they couldn't figure out the causes that went into it, and so thus it's something, it's like there's an intervention of nature.
If you just tuned in, this is Let's Talk About God on AP Radio, brought to you by WIP. It's 9:40.
Mm-hmm. Well, we actually are out of time, unfortunately. So, all right, last question then, Oscar. Mm-hmm. So then, under the species of eternity, so God would not actually be able to act or intervene within time itself, because God is within time itself.
But outside. Then,
outside of, wait, what?
Yeah, God's outside linear time.
Oh, yeah. But he's in within eternal time.
Mm-hmm.
Or is it necessarily different?
Or it's like kind of one saying, like, he is eternity. And,
okay. Yeah. But then within the, just doing a little conclusion, I guess, within Kant's form of God, God would be able to intervene?
God might intervene. However, God does exist outside of time, though his intervention is just sort of at random. I mean, a little bit more Old Testament perhaps, except God has to exist outside of a moral imperative as well, which God mandates. So Kant is a little convoluted on that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'll have to get into him sometime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys for coming on the show. Maybe we'll see you again soon.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah. And this has been Let's Talk About God show. This is Bear.
And Oscar.
And Fiona.
Thank you very much.
finally, to close out the hour, we feature the music of Billet Duxier, a master's student who plays in the band called Krummholz. This is their EP, Booted in Despair. AAP Radio is made by Savannah Rowe, Fiona McMurray, Elise Chauvel, and Isabel Gigi. That's me. Our theme music is made by Joe Chavez and Oliver Henry of Chateau Russe. Special thanks to Safia Benyaya, Kevin Four, Jürgen Hecker, Hannah Wesley, and David Blanc. That's all for AAP Radio. Tune in on Monday for more, and have a great weekend. Take care.